On today's podcast, we have Ben Greenfield of BenGreenfieldFitness.com. And this episode is brought to you by Mountain Ops. Mountain Ops is the leader in outdoor performance, energy, and nutrition. Their products are built by hunters for hunters. Because they understand better than anyone that your body's nutritional intake is vital to improve its overall health and performance while in the outdoors. That's why they build every product with the highest quality grade ingredients, providing your body with increased performance and real results. Whether you're looking to lose weight or build strength, get in shape for this upcoming hunting season with Mountain Ops and conquer your unknown today. Use the code NBH20 at checkout and receive 20% off your order. And be sure to tell them Will and Phil sent you.
To the Natural Born Hunter podcast, I'm host Will Bradley. And this podcast is a very special podcast. Not only is it the first ever all shirtless podcast, for those of you who are enjoying the video version, you will know exactly what I'm talking about. For those of you watching the or hearing the audio version, please imagine me having a six-pack.
Tits out.
On this episode, as always,
that's where the milk comes for the babies.
My co-host, Phil, the Iceman Mendoza.
What's up?
And a very special guest tonight, my boy, my dude, my bro, one of the most forward-thinking minds out there in the fitness community today, Ben Greenfield.
Chest freshly plucked.
That's nice. You have to pluck that. Mine just doesn't grow that
fast. No, I learned long ago from watching both my brothers attempt that if I try to grow facial hair, it winds up looking like chin pubes. So I don't really do much of that at all. Same thing with my chest. I don't touch it. It just doesn't grow.
That's not the look you want to go for, pubes on your face.
Well, actually, what I used to do, have you guys ever used Nair? Like
I have used it once, yes.
What?
Yeah, okay. So,
Wait, hold on. Both of you have used Nair?
Well, I used to do bodybuilding. And so you had to be, not only did you have to be completely hairless, but you had to, like, rub, like, gold flakes, like, tan stuff that would shimmer and shine underneath the lights once you stepped on stage. And I didn't, you know, now I'm into healthy living and detoxing and living a chemical free life and all this stuff. But Nair just basically melts all the hair off your body. You put it on there, melts the hair literally freaking like straight out of the pore. And then you wipe all the dead hair off with a cloth. And, I don't know. I doubt it's healthy, but
No, that sounds good. A product that, you know, you melt your body hair off with and then glitter yourself. That sounds like the healthy life. I'm surprised, you know, you're not pushing that more on BenGreenfieldFitness.com.
Works for pets and kids, too.
Hey, everybody, if you ever want to look like a shiny naked mole rat, check out Greenfield's new podcast.
I can start a blog like shavedcatswithcancer.com.
Yeah, that sounds popular. So, Phil, why were you using Nair?
Back in the day, man, I had to get the chest nice and clean, and I wouldn't say I was into bodybuilding. I was more into working out like a bodybuilder, and that was a thing to do. Clean chest, clean abs.
Are we talking
before I went to the beach?
Time? Or are we talking
Amen.
20?
I did the Nair once. I did laser hair removal.
What?
I've done waxing, and
that means he's probably bleached his asshole.
Yeah.
I have never bleached the cornhole.
Jug of porcelina.
No.
That's half used.
But I tell you, I never touched my arms, my forearms, and I'm glad because I got some of my buddies have like it looks like wire coming out of their arms now, and I never did that, so I'm glad. Mm. But the chest and the abs, that definitely got it.
How's it going? Wait, now what do you do now for your manscaping? What's the Phil Mendoza, you know, train to hunt championship program?
When I'm in a hurry, I take the clippers to it. That's what I do.
All right.
But that's about it, man. Just clean enough to where it doesn't bother me too much. But anyway, let's move on from the self-grooming and bleached cornhole talk.
You're right. We should move on. And I know from talking to Phil, before the show, we both were like, oh, what questions or topics do you want to bring up? And this is probably the perfect
time. This is a great time.
For
So, Ben, let me roll with this one out the gate. I caught some of one of your podcast episodes. Didn't get a chance to read the article, but it had something to do with strengthening your dong.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So let's go ahead and just break it out right now. What's all that about if one is to want to strengthen every muscle in their body, including their member?
All right. So as a health and fitness blogger, I get weird stuff in the mail all the time, products to try, and half of it winds up in the garage on a shelf, you know, shoved into the back somewhere. But this thing arrived at my house like a month and a half ago. It's called the Private Gym. And it's like this 2.5-ounce magnet weight that attaches to your schlong along with instructions for like a 30-day penis strengthening program that's supposed to, if you have things like impotence or erectile dysfunction, it's supposed to help with that. But it also is purported to help with sexual performance, like, you know, the power of your orgasm and like the strength of ejaculation and all that stuff. So I thought it would be interesting to try because honestly, a lot of my readers and listeners, they're focused on physical performance. And that's kind of part of it. And like past posts I've done on like libido and foods for enhancing sexual performance and stuff like that, they've been very well received. So I figured, what the hell? And I won't go into the nitty gritty details, but I put it through a 30-day trial. One of the instructions was that like you're supposed to just basically jack off while you use it so that you're able to lift it up and down. But, I don't know if we need to get into this part, but I'm actually not a big fan of porn because of what I think it does to the dopamine receptors in your brain. So I actually had my wife help me out for the full 30 days, and we'd just like whip that thing out in the bedroom and we'd stop, you know, and I'd do my exercises and then jump back in. And I detail all this in the blog post. I warned her before I published it that it was going to be a little bit explicit. And then, after 30 days, honestly, I did notice a big difference. I mean, I either did that or like the Kegel exercise strengthening program that came along with it. Every day for 30 days. And yeah, it's a.
So I don't, Will, are you with me? Or are you just,
Yeah.
Are you online trying to find it right now?
Yeah, he's purchasing. I'm in his credit card information right now.
I'm hitting the purchase button.
Everybody else is going to think I lost my internet connection, but what really happened was I immediately just said, forget these two. I could be strengthening my dong. You know, that thing could probably bench press 225 if I start doing it now.
Actually, you know, I'd heard of this before because I have a buddy who's in like the sex and dating industry, and he does this with like wet towels. Like he's done it for a couple of years, and this is just kind of like a little bit smaller, sexier, more compact and portable version of the wet towel trick.
So when you say he's in the sex industry, do you mean like he's on the corner of the street with the girls, or what are we talking?
No. He his name's Jordan Gray. He just like writes like ebooks and stuff about dating and sex and, you know, relationships and stuff like that. But he's also into like, you know, he does some of that stuff too, like tantric sex and sexual performance and that kind of writing. So yeah.
So what do you think?
So that was the Private Gym.
So what does porn do to the dopamine receptors in your brain? Just in case there's some guys out there who may watch it.
You know, yeah, dude, you should go to yourbrainonporn.com, and what they get into is the fact that we as humans, if you think about it from an ancestral standpoint, how often would it have been that you'd be like walking through the forest or hunting or gathering or farming or whatever, and you just come across like 30 beautiful naked women all wanting to have sex with you? Like your head would explode, right? It's just like we aren't evolutionarily, that's a word, capable of handling all of that stimulus thrown at us all at once. Let's just throw the whole like ethical, moral argument out the window and just approach it from like a biological standpoint. What happens is the dopamine receptors in your brain get overloaded, just like the adenosine receptors in your brain can get overloaded with caffeine, and you need more and more coffee to wake up, or to stay up or to feel energized. Same thing with dopamine receptors, right? Like if you overload them over and over again with the same stimulus, you either need more of that stimulus, more of it more often, different types of that stimulus. And basically what happens long term is like a norm, let's just say like a normal healthy relationship with your loved one, like it's not as satisfying because it just doesn't give you that huge dump of dopamine that, you know, that click, 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 click does. So that's kind of the overview of it. But that website kind of goes into it in a lot more scientific detail than that. So, does that make sense?
So basically sex is kind of like heroin.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, but I mean, not really.
Takes away from the other drugs, we would say.
Right. Yeah, in a way. You can think of it very similar as you would a drug. And I'm not saying like, you know, drugs are bad or sex is bad or anything like that, but just imagine if you like sat around all day dumping huge doses of heroin into your body. You know, that's kind of like similar to what frequent, you know, if I were to use porn for 30 days, right, for my private gym workout, I would imagine it probably would not enhance my relationship with my wife.
Dude,
so
it's nothing but porn and tons of heroin. That sounds like a Phil Mendoza.
Sounds like a night in Vegas.
I'm a happily married man, Will.
I wasn't going to throw myself under the bus on that one. Sorry, Phil.
And I don't think it was planned, by the way, for us to be half naked during this discussion. Exactly. Probably is slightly awkward to an observer.
Suns out, guns out, baby. Now that's some pretty progressive stuff. Did you grow up in a family that was very open about the sexual discussions and, you know, where babies come from, all that business, or did you just kind of develop this forward thinking, just hey, whatever, you know, people need to know this stuff later on in life?
Yeah, so first of all, I grew up in a very like strict Christian household where, you know, people would blush when Aladdin kissed Princess Jasmine on the cartoon, right? Like super duper strict. And you know, in our house though, it's you know, we're like a very moral, ethical family, but at the same time, I'm pretty straightforward with my kids and my wife and all of us, like about anything, you know, regarding anything from, you know, violence to sex to, you know, the birds and the bees or whatever. I am a fan of, when it comes to children, educating them to make really, really good decisions later on in life rather than protecting them from certain choices so that they never arrive at having to make that choice or encounter that topic later on in life, having viewed it as whatever forbidden fruit their whole lives and then messing up with whatever choice or decision they have to make in the moment. So I'd rather my kids from a very early age just be aware of and educated on the decisions that they're going to be making later on in life. So yeah, we're pretty open about things like, you know, sex, cursing. You know, if my children curse, I don't say that. I tell them what the word means, when it would be appropriate to use it, when it would be offensive and who not to use it around, and then let them go make the choice about whether or not they're going to use it. But I don't say something like, oh, you know, whatever, you said shit, go to your room.
Yeah.
I tell them, well, you know, shit is a word for excrement, crap, whatever, and these are the times when it's appropriate to use, and these are the times when you don't use it. And I wouldn't use it around your teacher and your friends at school because they're probably going to get offended by that and you might get in trouble. And, you know, then they go on and make their own decisions. So anything like that. I'm a bigger fan of being very open.
If they want to use those words, they can just come on the podcast, talk to me. You know,
right, exactly. Go talk to Will, Phil, Natural Born Hunter.
Lose the shirt.
And take off your shirt and talk about anything.
So how did you find out about – let me ask you this. I guess this is just for my own knowledge. How did you find out about the birds and the bees? Because I found out from my buddy Nick Gibson on the back of bus number 31, and it's like a TLC album, you know. So it's not been the same. Maybe that's, you know, how a lot of dudes found out. TLC was very popular back then. But Nick was the kind of kid who knew way more than every other kid did in fifth grade.
Yeah.
Was it simple for you, or did your parents sit you down and be like,
nah. So the way I learned about sex was we had a female boxer that, you know, went into heat from time to time during the year. And my parents like to breed their dogs, and so they had one of the male dogs. What do you call them? I think the male dogs are they call them studs?
I would assume.
Yeah, I think it was a boxer stud, a male boxer stud. They had the boxer over, and so my mom took me down to the kennel where the male and the female boxer were, and like the male was like chasing the girl around, you know, like growling, and he'd jump on top of her and she'd run away and he'd slam her into the fence and he'd jump on top of her again, and eventually they'd get locked together and they'd kind of like fight and he'd chew on her ear and she'd try and get away and they'd fight a little bit more, and then finally they'd, you know, do the deed. And I just kind of stood there. I was like, I don't know, I was probably 8 or 9, just watching the whole thing, under the impression that sex was this horrible, horrible, like, caged up experience, kind of like a UFC match where the female finishes, you know, completely shell shocked, and the male goes and laps up some water from the doggy bowl. And that was kind of my impression of sex from that point on until pretty much like high school. So
that made for a very awkward first date for your.
Yeah. State to the panel.
I've noticed. I sent you after the North Idaho Trained Hunt event. You and your boys were in the grocery store, and I observed. You were teaching them the, you know, I think you guys were picking out candy or something, and you were explaining to them the facts in what color animal, you know, on some of those, the darker chocolate bars represented the better ones and why that was, you know, so it's not, you won't be taking them to a kennel anytime soon, I guess I'd say.
No, I probably won't do a kennel. I don't know. I'm not sure. I haven't thought about what animal experience that I'll use for that. Maybe I'll start with something really innocent, like an ant farm. And I can see how little ants, I don't know, stuck together or whatever ants do. Honestly, dude, I don't know how ants have sex. Anyways, though, so maybe I wouldn't start with an ant farm. I'll have to think about that, though. Nobody's ever asked me that question before on a podcast, the best method to teach children about sex, if you aren't gonna use dogs. I don't know.
Phil, do you have a plan in place for the boys?
I ponder that. Yeah, maybe the monkeys. The zoo.
I'm going to have to put a screeching halt to this podcast right now and divert the train, because this is going this is interesting. But
hey, it's
still,
your guys' show. I'm just answering questions.
This is a terrible show.
Season here and back up a little bit. Ben, tell us how you got into the fitness industry, and let's start with that kind of educated answer, I guess. Where did you start out? Did you always know that this is the direction you wanted to go, or was it, you know, you said you used to do some bodybuilding and some other stuff?
Yeah, well, it all started when my mom brought me down to the horse stables. And no, I'm just kidding. Like Will spit of his beer. I got into tennis when I was 13 years old. Up until that point, I'd kind of dabbled a little bit in baseball, basketball, soccer, kind of like the typical, you know, American boy sports. And tennis really got me super interested in, like, everything from like how you could eat to enhance performance to, you know, going on runs to enhance fitness to, you know, I went to like Gart Sports and got the set of little 10-pound dumbbells and just like wanted to figure out ways that I could serve harder, chase down balls faster, et cetera. And tennis turned out to be like my big sport in high school. I played collegiate tennis, and just because most of the student athletes studied kinesiology or sports science or exercise science, you know, all glorified terms for just PE, I wound up being a PE major. And all through college, really found that I developed a keen interest in like math, science, medicine, biology, chemistry, etc. So I wound up going through pre-med, took all the pre-med classes, took the MCATs, got accepted to medical school. And all during that time, I had been moonlighting as a personal trainer. So I'd finish up my day at University of Idaho and go work as a personal trainer for a few hours. So, you know, I had my personal training cert and got my strength conditioning cert, and we did, you know, nutrition consulting and all that stuff all through college. Before going to medical school, I took a job in surgical sales to kind of like spend a little bit of time in the private sector, make some money, and then jump into school. And over that 5 months, I got totally disillusioned with medicine, modern medicine, Western medicine, et cetera. Every doc I was around, and I wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon or a sports medicine physician, every doc just hated their job. They were overworked. I was never told or encouraged once by anybody to actually go to medical school or go after that profession. So I wound up quitting that job at the end of the summer. I walked into a gym, asked for a job, and within 2 weeks was personal training full-time again. And really from that point on, it just kind of snowballed from there. I opened up a bunch of personal training studios across Idaho and Washington between Spokane and Coeur d'Alene, and spent the next 7 years training clients, coaching other trainers to train clients, building up a personal training business. Did a lot of exercise as medicine. So I partnered with a lot of the local docs because I was familiar with a lot of them. I spoke their language just from my experience up to that point. And so really worked quite a bit with patient referrals into my personal training clinics. And then also did a lot with laboratory equipment. So I purchased everything from like high-speed 3D biomechanics cameras to analyze like cycling and running analysis to like laboratory physiology equipment to measure VO2 max and metabolic rate. Did a lot of like blood work type of stuff that I would have the physicians run on the clients for whatever, iron, testosterone, all that stuff. And really tried to make a name for myself and my clinics as a place where you could go to kind of like, if nothing else was working for you for fat loss or muscle gain or stuff like that, like I would be the person that you go to. And in 2008, based on all of that and just kind of me trying to delve into a more unique niche, I was voted as America's top personal trainer. And from there, my job kind of more began delving into like traveling around the world and doing like speaking, consulting, writing, freelancing, podcasting, and kind of more of what I do now. Like I don't run any personal training studios or anything like that now. I just basically sit at home in my underwear and write or walk on the treadmill and talk to my buddies like you guys. So, but yeah, that was kind of how I got into this. Yeah, and got interested in the whole fitness world.
Do you I recently heard of I guess I heard of it for a while now, but the 4-hour work week, right?
Yeah, Tim Ferriss.
You follow do you follow that program or the behind it, or what's your day to day like?
So first of all, that book, in my opinion, should have been titled 4 Hours Doing the Shit That You Don't Like. because Tim Ferriss, I've been with him at conferences and stuff like that, and the dude works hard, right? Like he works way more than 4 hours a week. But the underlying idea behind the book is you do what you're good at, right? Mm-hmm. So I would say that, yeah, like I certainly adhere to that approach. I've got 12 different folks around the world who do everything from like researching products to tracking metrics to doing social media stuff to I run like I've got a couple of warehouses in LA and Philadelphia where we ship like supplements and fitness gear and stuff like that. So I've got customer service set up for those, and then shipping managers and people tracking inventory and people, you know, doing like labeling and graphic design, pretty much everything that I would be crappy at, so that I can do what I love to do and what I enjoy, which is like, you know, writing, speaking. I do like some one-on-one consulting, like fitness consulting and health consulting. But yeah, like one of the books that taught me a lot about how to do that, like outsourcing and using virtual assistants was the 4-Hour Work Week. And after reading that book, that was one of my chief inspirations to go and find a virtual assistant. And I literally went to Craigslist in Manila, Philippines, and posted a post in Manila, Philippines, hey, I need a virtual assistant. I need you to help me put together Excel spreadsheets with different contacts for people I want to reach out to. In that case, it was for like the triathlon industry, like put together a list of coaches for me to contact across the USA, put together a list of clubs, write out these emails, these templated emails, send them one by one from my email account, And in this case, it was for all these folks to get free, like a free ebook that I had written that they could then distribute to their clubs and their members to kind of like build traffic back to my website. But that was one of the first times I ever outsourced anything, and it worked out so well. Like, from there, it went into, like, you know, research and purchase books for me, and, you know, do everything a virtual assistant would do. So now I don't even mow my lawn. Like, I outsource just about everything.
Someone from the Philippines does that too?
That's right. They fly from the Philippines every week and mow. Yeah.
I actually was mowing my lawn before this podcast, and I thought, you know, part of me hates doing it and is like, I gotta have someone else mow my lawn. But part of me is doing it because I think of great ideas like, let's do a shirtless podcast.
Yeah, and there are some chores like that. Like, I love chainsawing, hauling wood, and chopping wood. Like, I do all that myself. I just get a big kick out of it. It's, you know, it's a workout. It's fulfilling. They've even done research that it boosts your testosterone. Whereas I haven't seen the same research for mowing your lawn, and I freaking just hate mowing the lawn, so I don't do it. But.
I found that most men enjoy running chainsaws and working with wood because if you've ever asked a dude to be like, oh, hey, can you trim this, like a tree or a bush or anything, if you come back and it's not a stump, you're lucky as hell. Everyone else is cutting as much off as they can.
Yeah, I actually, when I get asked to do that, I sculpt them into elves and wood fairies. So
I believe you could do a wood fairy.
Yeah, I do a nice wood fairy.
I believe that. How about for you, Phil? You mow your own lawn?
I do mow my own lawn, and I love to run a chainsaw.
What is that? What is it about running a chainsaw that makes you feel like you're literally He-Man, master of the universe?
I have no idea. It's everything. It's the noise. It's the cutting. I mean, like, I don't. Maybe lawnmowers just need to be cooler. You know, maybe they need to have, like, I don't know. First of all, take the blade covers off so there's a little bit more of like a danger component, like with a chainsaw, and then make grass really like big and thick and kind of like hard to chop. So you got to grunt and, you know, kind of like driving a sled on the football field.
See,
that might make lawn mowing a little better.
See, there are some things that I think would be up there, and that would be like, say, an excavator or a backhoe would be comparable to like running a chainsaw.
I also run an excavator.
I'm right on that, right, Phil? You run an excavator.
Oh, yeah.
Feel like you're part robot.
You know what it is, though. I you know, with us having the demo and excavating business, the family business, like my son, he loves to get on there and run the equipment with me. But now I don't so much like to run the equipment because it's just very much work. But there's something about running that excavator. It's like a huge video game toy that you just, I mean, it's the power in it. It's unreal. I hate video games, but I love running I like to run the excavator on that sense.
I'd run a chainsaw over play a video game any day.
Yeah.
You guys ever do a Spartan race or like a Tough Mudder?
No, why? Are you going to introduce chainsaws to it?
No, but I mean, like, it's got a lot of the, you know, it's got like barbed wire crawls and sandbag carries and, you know, carry buckets of gravel around, stuff like that. You know, if you like that kind of manual labor, you'd probably enjoy one of those races.
I do manual labor.
I've done the Tough Mudder.
So I'm avoiding it on my weekends. Literally, this week, my job was to build a rock wall, which had me basically deadlifting granite rocks to about lap height and stacking them on each other.
So if you did a Spartan race, you'd be PO'd the whole time. You'd be like, I'm freaking
getting paid.
I paid to do this.
Yeah. Like, no. You pay me to carry the buckets of gravel.
But you don't get to jump over little fires.
So you do quite a bit of the Spartan race, don't you, Ben?
Yeah, I do. I actually I compete and I'm trying to get more competitive at those. Like, I'll be flying over to Pennsylvania next weekend to race two races over there, and then flying to San Francisco the next weekend to race over there, gearing up for world championships in Lake Tahoe in October. I kind of started to get out of Ironman triathlon, which was my main sport about a year and a half ago, and shift more towards obstacle racing just because, frankly, I get a big kick out of it. And it's a ton of fun, and I love being out there competing on that field of battle. And it was just kind of a switch up from the nice, you know, like rich, pristine, spandex-clad, elitist, like triathlon industry and like the whole obstacle racing, it's a little bit more like, you know, dirt cheap, muddy, gritty, you know, man, just like more like blood and beer and tattoos, right? Compared to triathlon, which is all just like, you know, fine wine and expensive bikes. So, I like it quite a bit.
So what do you feel Train to Hunt falls into the category of events?
I would say Train to Hunt. Do you mean like in terms of difficulty or?
Just, you know, kind of like how you related the triathlon.
Yeah, in terms of like demographic. I would say that so Train to Hunt seems to have more people out at the events who are in it for a deeper, more meaningful reason than just getting out there and hurtling over obstacles with their friends on the weekend. Like most people I've talked to at Train to Hunt are there to become better hunters or there to actually do something with the fitness that they've built while hunting. And I deeply respect that, right? Like that ultimate functionality of fitness, really, right? Like going out and putting food on the table, going out and providing for your family. You know, I really like the nature immersion component of it as well. And then also, seems to me, at least at the events that I've been at so far, people are a little bit more, and maybe this is because of the nature of archery in particular, that you just kind of got to stop and be quiet a little bit more. People seem a little bit more like patient at those events, right? Like, especially cause we're standing around for a long time at the 3D shoot and, you know, in between each heat and stuff like that. Like it's just a little bit less, like barbaric and loud and screaming, right? Compared to like a Spartan race. But as far as the fitness component goes, I think, I would say it is more intense than a Spartan in terms of the meat pack and the challenge course. It's even more glycolytic and anaerobic than those events, but it's also shorter, right? Like even the shortest Spartan, you're still out there minimum 30 to 40 minutes, right? Which would be a long challenge course or something like Train to Hunt. So I'd say Train to Hunt is almost closer to like, you know, a CrossFit WOD or even shorter. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, right? Like I like that. And Will, you were there at the finish line, I think, of the Northern Idaho event, where I was like, you know, really, you know, for the ultimate sport of longevity and for something that doesn't beat you up and spit you out by having you spend like 4 to 10 hours at your, you know, red line, right? Like an Ironman triathlon would do, or like a Spartan Beast would do. Instead, with something like Train and Hunt, you're moving at a low intensity for long periods of time, like during the 3D shoot, right? Like 2 to 3 hours of low intensity moving, mm-hmm. walking, stopping, shooting. You are lifting heavy stuff, which is the meat pack, but it's not for a really, really long time, right? Like it's not like you're out there the whole day. And so the training leading up to that, you don't have to be putting 100 pounds on your back for like 12 hours at a time, right? It's brief periods of time. And then the challenge course, as intense as it is, you know, it's, you're not out there for hours and hours. You're not out there to the point of glycogen depletion where you got to take like 10 energy gels out there with you. And you don't feel as depleted and inflamed and beat up after something like that as you do after a long triathlon or Spartan race or something like that. And so I think if you look at it from like a joint standpoint or a longevity standpoint, I think ultimately it's a little bit more of an ancestrally appropriate sport, right? Like you're lifting, you're moving, and you're sprinting, but you're not necessarily going to battle for a dozen hours.
Yeah, here's the thing I think about too is like you said, the difference between Train to Hunt and Spartan races or obstacle races is the one component of the 3D shooter, the shooting, is it's very much like golf almost. Where mm-hmm. trying to get into that zone, or like yoga, where you just want to get into that zone and take yourself out of it. You know, I don't know much about Spartan races. I've never done one, but I know a lot of guys who do. And, you know, I don't know that there's any part of a Spartan race where you're trying just to completely take your mind and body out of what you're doing.
There are two parts of the Spartan race where you do that. And in my opinion, they're underplayed and they don't include enough components like this into the race. But there's the spear throw, right? Where You're stopping and you're throwing a spear 20 to 30 feet at a target. Mm-hmm. And that actually is, I mean, it's tough. That's what most people fail, because they either don't practice the spear throw or else they don't stop, breathe, center, and release, right? They just run up there and just like huck that spear as hard as they can in the general direction of the target. And then they do their 30 burpees. The other component is a memorization component. And they have this in the Spartan Beasts, where you'll run past a big wall that will have a list of numbers on it. You got to match up your race number to that wall, and then there is a word and a number code, like uniform 7766165. And you memorize the word and the code, and it might be 7 miles later that you got to spit that out. And so you and again, a lot of people burpee fail that because they don't have the awareness to actually, you know, on the field of battle, right? Like in the heat of the battle, be able to commit something to memory that's important, be able to get their brain to work in more of that left brain mode, and then spit that out later on. So Spartan does have that component, but it's definitely not as intensive as something like Train to Hunt. I would say the closest corollary to Train to Hunt would be like speed golf, right? Which is actually a pretty popular sport now. And it's literally just what it sounds like. It's getting through 18 holes in 60 to 90 minutes. And your total time is not just your stroke count, but your actual time on the course. And so you're having to move fast and also be able to stop, focus, you know, swing, aim, putt, et cetera.
With a Spartan race, what would you say if I could change or add? Let's say add something to it. What would you add to Spartan racing?
Oh, dude, I would add, and maybe this is just because I love water, I love swimming, and I love having to deal with the elements, either hot or cold. I would love to see more like cold water swims, cold water plunges, longer periods of time in the water. But there's obviously like kind of like insurance and mm-hmm. liability considerations for something like that too. But like that's, you know, like this morning, you know, my workout was a 30-minute cold water swim. And I do a lot of hypoxia. I'm taking a free diving course in November to get a little bit more into free diving and spearfishing. And I just love the water. So I'd love to see more of like a water component.
What would you add to a Train to Hunt event? Would it be water as well, or?
You really want to know?
As long as it's not more running, yes. If it is, then shut your mouth.
I'd make the meat pack like 5 times longer. Not necessarily like hours and hours, but I'd make the meat pack an event that would take like a good like 45 to 60 minutes.
So that's Aaron with Kafaru. We've talked about it, and he said the same thing. He felt like a true representation of what you're going to experience in the hills is maybe like a 40 pounds in, 2 to 3, 4 miles in, and then you load up another 40 pounds, and then you have 80 pounds to come all the way back out, you know.
Yeah.
So you've got 4 to 6 total miles, and you're actually somewhat simulating more of what you would in a hunting scenario.
I agree. There's two reasons I agree. Number one is what you just outlined. It is more conducive to what you'd experience in a hunt. And number two, it trains the one physiological system that doesn't get tested during a train to hunt event, which is just pure endurance and stamina.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, like you said before, it's more sprint simulated with what the events have been so far. I think that, you know, I don't know. I've done, I think, 5 now, and everyone's a little different based on the terrain. And the meat pack, I did one last year when we were still carrying 200 pounds. And because I was in the lead after the shooting, the one down in Casper, I got to watch everybody do the meat pack event, and I got to see where I needed to be. And two guys did all 200 pounds and what I thought was one of the steeper courses that I'd been to. And I just opted to just do it in 2 trips. I said, I can move 125 and then come back and get 75 pretty quickly. And I still managed to finish in the top 3 in the meat pack just because I got to see. But that one turned into more of a stamina type race. But either way, I mean, I think that you're right. I think that a couple things restrict or prohibit that. Now, like Colorado, we had 106 at the last event. As these events grow and you have 120 or 140 competitors, either they're going to have to go to some kind of chip, some kind of timer chip on a whatever you pin to your shirt or your shoe, or you can release 15, 20 competitors at a time, make it longer, and then they all come in on automatic timer. That would solve that problem, but it just depends on, because most of these events are being held on archery ranges. There's not that much property on most archery ranges.
Well, you know, the other problem with that is sandbag quantities.
Mm-hmm.
But how about this? I mean, you carry an empty sandbag with you, go up the hill, there's going to be a scale. You load up rocks or wood or whatever, and then pack it back out. You know, weigh it, make sure it meets the weight requirement, pack it out.
I'm taking a pound of wood then.
They actually do that in the Spartan race. They have the bucket carry. They have little holes in the bucket, and if a ref sees any air through those holes towards the top of the bucket, you automatically dump your bucket, return, refill it, and you have a burpee penalty. So, you know, you're responsible for generating your own weight, but it is refereed to a certain extent. I think one of the issues with train to hunt, if you were to take, you know, everybody, have them do a longer meat pack and have them all start at once. Let's say that you did have a chip timed, right, and you hurdle that barrier. The only other issue that I see is, whereas with a Spartan, you can have four guys racing down the side of a mountain, side by side, neck and neck, you know, or one guy back, one guy forward. And if somebody takes a spill, it's not that big of a deal. Whereas if somebody's running behind me with whatever 80 or 100 pounds in their back, if they go down, there's great potential for a lot more carnage in terms of who's going to go down around them and that type of thing. So once you get a lot of people neck and neck on a course, I think it's difficult. You know, one thing that Spartan did at World Championships last year, And it was about a 14.5 mile course last year, and about 3.5 hours or so into the race, I was looking at my watch and feeling pretty confident. That was about the 12 mile mark or so. I was feeling pretty confident about a 4 hour finish time. And I came around a corner to this obstacle, and it was a sandbag carry. And most of these races take place at ski resorts, right? Like Train to Hunt's location of choice are archery ranges. Spartan is usually ski resorts. And it was just this huge pile of sandbags at the base of a double black diamond that literally went like 3/4 of a mile up. And you had to grab two sandbags. These were two 60-pound sandbags and get them both up and down. And that obstacle wound up taking a little over an hour. Some people literally were out there like 2 hours sitting down on the ground, like with their face buried in their hands, crying because they had like all this, you know, they were running out of water, running out of fuel, because all of a sudden the race just got way, way longer. And there were only a couple of people, you know, kind of like this train hunt idea of, do you take, you know, two trips with a 200-pound meat pack? A couple of people were able to handle two sandbags, and most people just leapfrogged it, right? So they carry like a 60-pound sandbag up 30 feet, go down, grab the next one, leapfrog and carry that one up. You know, and that was the way that they did it. But, you know, that's another option, is you just have people, you know, carry big old sandbags up a steep hill.
You know, there's plenty of places to do it. It's just a matter of working that out. But you're right. There's, I don't know. I mean, it's Kenton's baby. I've enjoyed playing the game. And that was a good question. Well, I think that, you know, a longer meat pack, I agree, also I think would be or just restructured, if you will, would be cool to see.
And more Kegel exercises. He's more private gyms out there.
Yes, get the cock weights out.
The 2.5 ounce weights. Lift, release, lift, release.
I got plenty of 1 ounce weights on my stabilizer. I might have to modify and remove some of those.
It's actually a good idea. I could probably use that as a stabilizer weight.
I got a big 5 ounce one if you want. how are you liking getting into archery? I mean, I know you did it a little bit before, but I'm sure doing Train to Hunt, it's really upped your percentage of time you're doing it.
I love it. You know, I think I'm 5 months into being an archer or owning a bow. And yeah, I mean, I'm out almost every day doing a little bit of shooting, and for me, it's almost like meditation. You know, I find it really relaxing, unless it's an actual train hunt workout, in which case it's a little bit more stressful, you know, with your shooting with your heart rate up and stuff. But just going out and shooting, I love it. For me, you know, you made that analogy to like golf earlier. Well, you know, it's kind of like that. I get that same feeling. It's just like, you know, you check out and It's a good way to let your mind go elsewhere, good way to build your focus, your breathing, your mindfulness. I love it. I honestly, all I've done is firearm the past 3 years, and I am chomping at the bit so hard to go out this September. I'm going with my friend Chad up here elk hunting, and I mean, like, I cannot wait. It's like I'm looking forward to that more than I am to, like, you know, Spartan World Championships and, you know, everything else I'm doing this year. I'm really looking forward to.
I guess that's kind of the difference too at a train to hunt event, is where everyone there is like, yes, you know, they're there for the train to hunt event, but their minds are really focusing on the upcoming hunting season.
Right.
Whereas, exactly. I guess with Spartan Race, that is the season.
Yeah. And that's kind of like the awkward part for me, right? Like, is I've only ever hunted firearm. And so, you know, even when I'm at the train to hunt competitions, I still feel a little bit left out, right? Because I haven't actually gone on my hunt yet, because, you know, I literally haven't been shooting since I've had a hunting season available to me. So, I'm really looking forward to it. And I think that's going to probably even expand my enjoyment of shooting even more.
I get pretty, you know, I can get carried away with train to hunt training and the shooting and all that, but then hunting season comes and it's just, I'm like a crack addict out there, you know. I have to be out there, and if I'm not out there, all I can do is think about what's going on in those woods when I'm not there, what's walking by when I'm not there, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I live out in the middle of the forest, you know, on a bunch of acreage out here, so I've got animals all over the place out here, and, you know, my mom has 50 acres over in Post Fall, Idaho, and, you know, I've got plenty of land to go shoot on, but I'm just sitting around waiting till September, so.
So this will be the first year you're archery hunting then?
Yep, yeah.
Phil and I have talked about this, I don't remember if it was on the podcast or privately, but the difference between, say, hunting an elk and a whitetail and, you know, elk's much more active, which is, you know, whitetail is more of a chess game, a little bit more, you know, passive. You're really just trying to set up yourself in as many positions as you can till that animal makes a mistake, you know. And I haven't elk hunted, but I will say, and a lot of guys be like, you know, whitetail seems kind of boring, but the more I'm learning and the better I'm getting at it, the more of an addiction it becomes. The more of that, you know, if you enjoy, I don't know, have you hunted whitetail before or always elk?
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah, whitetail, always whitetail. And, I mean, I agree. It's just, it's a lot of sitting and a lot of waiting, you know, at least just traditional firearm for whitetail. So, yeah.
Yeah, bows pretty much the same. I'm lucky enough where I'll see a lot of deer, but not necessarily a lot of deer I want to see. But, you know, any day I'm out there and I get to see anything, it's still, you know, like the old saying is, any day hunting is better than a bad, you know, any bad day hunting is better than a good day at work.
Yeah, well, my last hunt was pretty interesting because I travel all over the place, and a lot of times it is during hunting season. And so the last one, I had just returned from Japan, and I had one day, it was the last day of hunting season. I got back from Japan and I was turning around to fly to Canada the next day. And so I literally, like, got up after being on the airplane, you know, arriving home at 1 a.m. I got up at 6 and literally just went traipsing off into the forest, keeping my fingers crossed I would get something. And I walked, like, 50 yards, and I heard some grunting and just, you know, hit the ground. And there was a big buck came running up past me literally within, like, 15 minutes after I'd started walking. And I shot him and walked back into the kitchen. It took me 5 minutes to walk back into the kitchen and got my wife and boys to come out and help me dress him. But it was literally just, and then, you know, just brought it down to the butcher because I had no time and just flew out the next day. But you know, that was a super quick one, the last one.
Oh, I hate you. That never happened.
But they are, like, a lot of the deer out here. I mean, like, we have a big, we got these 8 raised garden beds out here to the left of my office. And I mean, our deer fencing is, like, sky high, cause they're literally like rodents around here. So,
but that's more the exception to the rule of, I walked in the woods 5 minutes later, I had myself a deer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or unless, I mean, it's just your Ben Greenfield, and apparently, you know. No, all my hunting trips have always been less than 10 minutes.
Yeah,
When do you think more people from, say, the Spartan race or, you know, the fitness communities you're currently involved in, do you see them crossing over into the hunting world or the train to hunt universe?
You know, it's tough to say. I think, honestly, it comes down to looking at people's relationship with food, because that's ultimately what hunting in most cases is, or at least I think, you know, should be. And even in the health and the fitness industry, I would say we're still at the point where at least 80% of the population in that industry is still primarily purchasing their food in a format that includes nutritional labels that you can scan, right? Packages, boxes, cans, bottles, etc., bars, gels, that type of thing. A lot of people are like having their foods made for them, right? This whole like paleo meal delivery, you know, like you know, frozen paleo friendly meals, stuff like that. You know, and some people are like starting to get into like farmers markets, CSA, stuff like that, but it still hasn't really saturated the health and fitness industry that much. Like, people still almost seem afraid to have this intimate connection with their food, or even, you know, dare I say it, they're lazy and don't want to learn how to prepare food, how to make it taste good, you know. And you know, I work with clients who have this deep-rooted desire to whatever, have a six-pack abs and live till they're 100 and, you know, get every anti-aging and longevity tool under their belt and lose fat and build muscle, but they don't want to freaking take 45 minutes to learn a new food and to cook dinner and to, you know, go shopping for maybe some fresh produce that they haven't used before. And so I think a big part of it is people first have to overcome their fear of being really intimate with their food and where that food is sourced from and how to prepare it, and just, you know, basically stop being lazy, because otherwise what will happen is you'll get a bunch of people who are getting into hunting for whatever the fitness component who kill an animal and don't really have the time or the knowledge or the motivation or the desire to actually, you know, prepare that animal into food. So I think that's where the barrier lies, right? Like, people need to not be afraid of a, you know, an eggplant, a rutabaga, and a parsnip before they start getting into hunting, because otherwise, you know, you just have a bunch of people walking around killing animals and not doing anything with them.
Yeah, and that'd probably be the worst thing that could happen to hunting.
Yeah, exactly.
What, when you took that deer, or I guess any deer, and this is something I don't think that gets talked about much outside of the hunting community, but what were your, say, what were your feelings or emotions at that time? What was your connection?
You know, it's first a big rush of adrenaline, right? You're sprinting to where you see that the animal fell. You're keeping your fingers crossed that it's going to be about where you saw it go down. You know, your heart is pounding, and then you eventually, you know, you come up on the animal, and then you know, honestly, in my case, there's some sympathy. You feel bad a little bit, because there's a spirit, there's a soul, there's a living being there that's going to die for your needs. You know, and then there's a little bit of like, you know, assuming that, you know, and this is the case with the last two animals I shot, like, I had to still put it away. You know, in both cases, I just used a shot to the neck, and, you know, there's a lot of hesitation at that point, right? Just that point blank shot. And then, you know, from there, at that point, I would say there's a little bit of pride mixed with a deep, deep connection to the planet, to the earth, to the elements, to life, to death. You know, you have your hands in warm blood. You have the stench in your nostrils, which is just like this deep kind of earthy slash stinky, you know, slash salty smell. And, you know, and so all of your senses are involved in a really, really deep and meaningful way. you know, and afterwards, you know, once you've actually, you know, you've dressed it and, you know, it's ready to go. And, you know, in my cases, I'm usually, you know, dragging it with a tarp back to the truck. You know, it's just, you know, it's tough to say at that point. It's like a feeling of pride, but also a sense of like accomplishment, the hunt being over. And then honestly, you know, like last night for 4th of July, you know, I was eating that animal, right? Like I had a deer burger with white pepper and black pepper and sea salt and cayenne and paprika, and, you know, it soaked in a little bit of lemon juice all day. And you know, and that's a little bit of a cool feeling too, knowing exactly where that animal came from. You know, in my case, eating a hamburger and looking off to my left 200 yards and knowing that, you know, that's where that animal actually came from. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of emotions. It's a good question. I've never been asked that before, but yeah, a lot of emotions all rolled up into one.
I asked that question, and I don't know if I would describe it much different than you would. I don't know. That's pretty in line with how I would describe it. There's a lot of emotions, you know, and I don't want to say like regret or remorse, but there is that, like, you know, I can always picture that, you know, I guess it would be more of an Indian-esque lifestyle where, you know, you thank Mother Earth and all that sort of thing, where it is that, you know, you're very thankful for, you know, the life you took. However, it's a very, you know, serious, humbling experience. I really haven't gotten the words figured out for myself of how to describe it. I think you did a really great job. Phil, would you say you've got the same kind of emotional wave going on?
Oh yeah, I mean when you take, you know, like you said, when you take that animal's life, there is that feeling, like Ben said, not so much regret, but you know, you've taken a life, and knowing that it's for the benefit of, you know, your health and your continuous, that's where I just I don't get emotional to where, you know, I get down and start tearing up. I don't get like that, but you definitely feel respect, and it is that roller coaster of emotions from like, you know, when you guys talk, when the adrenaline is super high to you come up on the animal, and then it's like, okay, it's, you know, and then you have to kind of calm yourself. So it is very, it's a very difficult time or experience to describe. I mean, there's a bunch of emotions that go into that one experience. And I think that's part of what hooks people for hunting, because when you've experienced that many times or a couple times or even one time, you know, it's so hard to describe that you just want to experience it again. And I don't know. I think that's a good explanation of why I'm hooked, maybe.
Yeah, and you know, if I could throw this in, and this might be to my complete destruction on a hunting podcast to say this, returning to that feeling of regret, that feeling that you have just caused death, right? I think that in an ideal, pristine, perfect world, there wouldn't be any death of actual, like, souls, spirits, animals, stuff like that. I think that in an ideal, pristine world on top of a Himalayan mountaintop or in heaven or however you want to picture this, that we probably could just all survive on, like, the living greens that grow up from the earth. And I think that maybe that's the way that things originally were. But, you know, the reality of things now are that we live off of the death of other creatures, and that's what feeds our spirits, our souls, our blood, our muscles, everything. You know, and that's just the reality. And I think that a feeling of regret that you've killed a creature is not necessarily something that is unnatural or unhuman. I think that maybe it's tied to that idea that somewhere, you know, in an ideal world there wouldn't be any death. And so, you know, I think that, you know, I don't necessarily feel that, like, a feeling of regret is something that that is wrong or unnatural, at least like a fleeting feeling of that. But, and now, you know, compared to what we started talking about on this podcast, we've all of a sudden gotten very, very deep and meaningful. But I mean, related to that though, like my kids do a lot of wild edible gathering, right? Like I'm teaching them a lot about all of the edibles that are around us here on the land. And one thing I'm very careful to have them do, even when they're picking whatever pineapple leaf or miner's lettuce or nettle or whatever, is they say thank you to Mother Earth, right? Like they take it with gratitude. And I think that's the other thing that's really, really important, you know, in this discussion, is you always have to remember everything that went into getting you what you got, whether it be a plant or an animal. And I think that gratefulness and gratitude and a sense of mindfulness in terms of where what is sustaining you came from is really, really important.
I think you really kind of you hit on a really great point there of, you know, you're kind of taking from the bounty that is the earth. And because right. everything that's living is living off the death of everything else, really.
Right.
Even if you look at a mushroom, you know, and where they grow, or, you know, the death of one tree so another tree can grow up, you know, and cloud out other trees, whatever it is. It's all very natural, but you're also very, very grateful to be part of the whole chain. And I think what human beings have kind of done is let other people, you know, take care of whatever it takes to get, you know, the food from point A to point B, and they have no need to really be grateful. You know, they just come in, they exchange cash for whatever. And there's no connection, no emotion, no nothing tied to their food other than maybe, you know, the whole hunger and satiation. And when I've taken an animal's life, I feel like I have been directly hardwired into the planet for a moment. And eventually, later on, that moment will pass, but it kind of fades as the night will go on. And then you remember it when, say, you were eating this meal this 4th of July, you know, you're almost going back and transported to those, you know, connection and able to relive it. And I've never experienced a better meal than one that's come from something I took myself. It's almost ruined kind of nice restaurants for me. You know, it's nice, but.
Yeah. Heightened senses.
Yeah.
So since we're on the topic of eating, right, where we're getting it, Ben, you've got a your diet, the meal program you kind of follow right now is that of one that's higher in fats. And I have a question, and it's more so I have two, potentially three, 5 to 7 day hunts, backpack style hunts this year.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me a little bit what your opinion or what your thought is, if that type of diet is really, I see it as being very difficult to sustain that kind of a diet in the backcountry, you know, living off what you put in your pack, you know, especially where everything, you know, it's such a weight critical issue with what you carry into the backcountry. Have you thought about, I don't know what, you know, your hunts you have coming up, but am I off base here thinking that that's going to be difficult for someone that's following that kind of a meal plan to carry on with that in the, you know, when they're packing it in their pack for 5 or 7 days?
So one important consideration here is that even the leanest of hunters is heading out into the field with a good 25,000 to 30,000 calories of storage fat available to them. The fact is, though, that if your diet when you're not hunting is comprised of cereal for breakfast, a whole wheat bread sandwich for lunch, and pasta for dinner, your body is very efficient at burning sugars and carbohydrate chains as a fuel. And what happens from a physiological standpoint is you actually lower your mitochondrial density, your ability to oxidize fat, and also the hormones that are responsible for mobilizing fatty acids from adipose tissue, wherever you tend to store that on your waist or your hips or whatever, in order to be available as energy. Whereas if you go out in a fat-adapted state, you can get by on less food because you're burning fatty acids. And as a secondary fuel, you're burning ketones. And so, you know, I had about an hour and a half long discussion on my podcast with a sports nutritionist named Barry Murray, who specializes in preparing athletes for ultra endurance events, right? Like very, very long multi-day bike stages, ultra runs out in the mountains for like 50 miles on minimal fuel. And we talked about the steps to becoming fat adapted to the point where you're relying primarily upon your body's own storage fat during those events and carrying minimal fuel sources. And a few of the rules were, in addition to eating a higher percent of your normal diet from fat rather than sugars and carbohydrates, to incorporate things like intermittent fasting, meaning having periods of time each day of the week where you're going for about 12 hours or so without eating, right? So if you stop eating at 9 p.m., you wouldn't eat again until 9 a.m. To forsake the idea of frequent snacking and grazing, and to instead have a typical day comprised of 3 to 4 meals, and more appropriately, 3 square meals, and if you're working out, some kind of a snack, pre-workout or post-workout. The idea of what's another one that we delved into for that? Fasted exercise sessions, meaning like morning fasted aerobic sessions where you're going for anywhere from 20 to 60 minutes in the morning, not with a WOD, not with something very draining or stressful, but like a mild aerobic activity like swimming, jogging, walking, hiking, etc., that is training your body how to operate in a state that's not reliant upon blood glucose, but rather reliant upon fatty acids. And once you string all these strategies together, you get to the point where you can go for very, very long periods of time without fuel, right? So like, you know, my kids are fully fat adapted. They just don't do Cheerios and fruit roll-ups. And, you know, a typical meal for them is like, you know, sardines and avocados over a bed of greens, right? And so, you know, that we recently went on a wilderness survival course, and we were with a group of people, and the three of us at one point went for almost 20 hours, you know, building a debris a shelter, you know, boiling our water, doing all that, and we didn't eat a thing. And we were fine until dinner because we're all very fat adapted. But time is important to take into consideration. When you shift to the type of scenario I've just described, it takes 2 weeks to even feel like you're in the land of the living. Like you feel like complete crap when you shift from higher carb intake to higher fat intake, intermittent fasting, fasted workout, stuff like that. It takes a good 6 months before you start to be able to perform well on a diet like that. And for something like Ironman triathlon, it took me over a year before I got to the point where I could do an Ironman, primarily relying on things like coconut oil, medium chain triglycerides, chia seeds, and fats, rather than the stereotypical like maltodextrin fructose-based gels. So that's kind of the long answer to your question. And the short answer is get fat adapted so that you have to carry minimal fuel and you're burning your own fuel, with the only, you know, drawback to that being that you'll come back with less storage fat and you might have to go through a feeding cycle after the hunt to kind of build back up your fat stores if that's something that's important to you.
So potentially if someone who is adapted to that and gets themselves prepared well ahead of time, that could be the answer to ultra lightweight hunting, where you're having to carry less because you need less.
Very, so, very simple chemical equation. Protein and fat is 4 grams or 4 calories per gram. Right. Fat is 9 calories per gram, right? So double the calories with half of the volume or half of the weight.
Yeah. So that, I mean, it's definitely something that backpack style hunting or backcountry hunting, you know, there's guys that, they have it down to, you know, so many calories per ounce, and, you know, they calculate everything, how many thousand calories they're going to carry with them per day, and a lot of it is based on dehydrated meals, a lot of it's based on, you know, your granola bar or your, you know, energy bar type stuff,
yeah,
and sugars, you know, a lot of sugary foods to keep those calories, to add those calories.
Yeah, you want to go for dense water void. Because they're light, you know, just like you wouldn't want to go for a water dense source of carbohydrates like, you know, pears or apples or something like that. That'd be suicide during a race or a hunt. You want to go for water void, nutrient dense fat sources. Examples of that would be like one of the more fat filled nuts that you can get, or macadamia nuts, coconut oil, either in coconut oil packets or in a coconut oil like filled Ziploc. Any of these fat based energy gels that are popping up now on the market that are primarily like almond butters, nut butters, chia gels, things like that. Chia seeds are also very nutrient dense. The nice part about those is you can mix them in water once you do get to a water source, and they expand, and they're incredibly satiating. So, you know, a few tablespoons of chia seeds will give you 250-plus calories, and, I mean, that's a very small amount of chia that will expand to, like, that much chia once it gets in water for an hour. So there are a lot of ways that you can carry fat, sustain energy levels, and avoid a lot of, like, the energy fluctuations and the non-fat adaptation that goes with carbohydrates.
I think that's something we need to talk about more, because there's a lot to that, and maybe on another episode. But yeah, there's guys out there, like I said, that spend way more time than I do hunting the backcountry. I you know, with working two jobs and the family, it's my time's limited, so it's very focused. But just like we prepare for everything else, we prepare with our shooting for train to hunt. We prepare with our shooting for hunting. We prepare with, you know, physical fitness for any kind of activity or hunting. You know, tying in the proper diet that can benefit you on that, you know, that backcountry hunt with less food. I think that there's a lot of hunters out there that probably their ears just perked up a little bit, because they're like, oh, I don't have to carry this, I don't have to carry that. You know, I think there's a lot to that.
And one thing that I discovered a couple of years ago that's magic is pemmican, which is just rendered fat. It's a Native American recipe. You can make it yourself. I also, just for convenience sake, I order it from U.S. Wellness Meats, just like organic pemmican. And it's literally just a stick of pure fat. And it's preserved with a little bit of sea salt, a little bit of honey. And man, that stuff will, like, one little tube of that will keep you going for like 6 hours easily.
Wow.
That and butter.
Butter's a little harder to carry around, though, especially in those warm August, September days.
I'm telling you, the native.
If you do have a stick of butter and you find some plants and some mushrooms, even if you don't have any meat at all, you can have a good meal with some butter and plants.
Yeah.
Or just rub it on yourself and wait for a bear to come get you.
That's right, baby. Use yourself as live bait. Hey, guys, I got a volleyball game coming up pretty soon.
Yeah, we'll cut you loose. I just one question came in, and it was, what are you doing to prepare yourself for train to hunt nationals with the higher elevation?
All right.
Is it the elevation mask, Ben?
You guys are gonna hate me because I got an ace in my whatever. How does the phrase go? Ace in your pocket, ace up your sleeve, whatever. I have one of these hypoxic air generators.
Of course.
That I used for an Ironman triathlon a couple of years ago. It's been sitting in my garage for a while. And Spartan World Championships are in Lake Tahoe this year. And that's the first week of October. It takes about 8 weeks for your body to build up enough erythropoietin and extra new red blood cells to be ready to compete at elevation. And so my original plan was to start training with that in August, using what's called intermittent hypoxic training, meaning that you exercise for a period of time, usually 5 to 10 minutes with the mask on, then you take it off, you breathe normal air, you put the mask on. And the reason that intermittent hypoxic training works better than continuous hypoxic training is because continuous hypoxic training puts you in that state of low oxygen availability for such a long period of time that you get a headache and you get some of the fatigue and some of the decrease in the ability to push hard during that workout compared to if you go on and off. So I literally, since it's been 2.5 weeks now, since I found out I was going to be coming down to Colorado, I've just been slapping that thing on every day and doing 30 to 60 minute sessions of intermittent hypoxic training. I pretty much quit running outside, which kind of sucks because I love to run out in the sun through the trees on the trail. But, you know, at this point, just because of sport specificity and event specificity, I have a treadmill out in my garage, my little torture chamber, blank white wall in front of the treadmill, my little elevation simulator right there next to the treadmill. And I put that thing on and just go to the pain cave for a little while. Mask on, mask off, mask on, mask off. Sometimes carrying a sandbag, sometimes running, but that's it. That's all I'm doing. And honestly, even with that, even with the intermittent and getting the exposure, I still have a low-level headache for a good 4 to 5 hours after each one of those sessions.
And how much does something like that cost?
Thousands and thousands of dollars, but they rent them for a few hundred bucks a month. I want to say like 400 for $500 a month.
I will not be doing that, but great answer.
But that's what I'm doing. I mean, that and just, you know, honestly, that I use, like, you know, cordyceps and rhodiola and those kind of herbs and stuff. But I use those more for, like, my hormone health than I do because they're good at elevation. But those are things that a lot of, like, Sherpas use. And those might come in handy, too, for something like train to hunt, right? Like a lot of these adaptogenic mushrooms and herbs that help when you're performing at elevation. So that, and I've frozen my own blood to be reinjected.
I was going to say, why don't you use blood dough? Yeah. That would be real helpful.
So if I drop dead of a heart attack during the meat pack, it's because I've got sludge for blood.
Yeah, you know, we'll cover it up, though. Can't have a well-known guy like you dropping dead at one of these events. That's bad for business.
Yeah, that's right. Just bury me.
No, he got hit by a car. That's why he's on the road.
He got shot.
Yeah. He shot himself with a bow. I wouldn't have believed it.
Misfire.
Yeah. Arrow came backwards right into his head.
Right.
All right. Well, we will...
Yeah, we appreciate it, Ben. I mean, it was fun, and you know, we obviously tell all our listeners that don't know Ben Greenfield where they can check out your stuff, or, you know, where they can find you and learn more.
BenGreenfieldFitness.com is a good place to go. I've got a bunch of books I've written over there. I have a podcast, articles about making your penis bigger and stronger, and all sorts of good stuff. So that's a good place, BenGreenfieldFitness.com, and it is female friendly too. So, and as I'm serious about that. Ever since I released that article, I've got a bunch of clamoring from the women about, like, what can I do? So one of my upcoming podcasts is with this lady who literally that's what she does, is she teaches women how to have a strong vagina. So
fantastic.
Look forward to that too. There you go.
There we go.
Come full circle.
You got
touched on everything tonight.
Yeah. Got anything else we got to talk about, Phil, or is that
No, man. I'm good. We'll let Ben go do his thing. We appreciate his time tonight.
Yeah. Thank you for everything, Ben. Don't bother trying to friend him on Facebook because he's at his limit. No friends.
But I have a Facebook page.
But he does have a page.
Awesome. Well, I'll see you guys in Colorado, I guess.
All right, man. Sounds good.
Yeah, have a good night, everybody. This has been the Natural Born Hunter Podcast, shirtless edition. Hope you all enjoyed.